You're listening to the Christian Humanist Radio Network, ChristianHumanist.org.
This is the last cowboy song, the end of 100-year wars. The voices sound sad as they're singing along, another piece of America's lost.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the City of Man podcast. My name is Coyle Neal and I am an associate professor of political science at Southwest Baptist University in Bolivar, Missouri. Joining me today, we have two guests, and I forgot to include their information on my outline here, so I'll let them introduce themselves. Michael, why don't you start, since I think you'll have either the shortest or the most complicated introduction, depending on how you want to do this.
Yeah, I'm Michael Farmer. I'm an unemployed PhD. I used to work at Crown College in St. Bonifacius, Minnesota, but I turned in my resignation earlier, and now I don't work there anymore. So, not checking my email, turned in my keys. It's nice.
Although by the time this posts, you might be employed somewhere.
Well, I hope so, given that you haven't posted the second or the third episodes yet.
Right.
Or is it the third or the fourth? I don't know. There's still two before this one to be posted. So we're all hoping I have a job by then, but who knows?
There are four before this one to be posted.
Oh, well. I'll either be on the dole or I'll have a job.
Barista Michael Farmer, welcome to the show.
I keep talking about going to work at the grocery store. It seems like kind of a relaxed job.
You know, my wife did that in high school, and she loved it. Like, she thought it was fantastic.
It just seems like it'd be all right. I mean, if it only paid.
Right. And it might depend on what you're doing, too. If you're, like, scrubbing toilets or whatever, that might be less fun than if you're doing stock or something. But
yeah.
Our other guest will have a more standard introduction, I assume. Danny, how's it going?
Oh, I'm fine. My name is Danny Anderson, and I guess, so I am still assistant professor of English at Mount Aloysius College in Pennsylvania, and I'm doing, you know, better than some, not as good as others, I suppose. So,
Right, better than all the bad people out there, right? That's the important part.
Some of them. I don't know. Usually the bad people do a lot better than me.
the wicked prosper.
That's right.
Well, we're still talking our way through country music. We're moving today into the 1970s. I feel like there should be a transition here from the Wicked Prosper.
I have a very country music story to tell about my car.
Oh, go for it.
The speedometer doesn't work anymore because it's a 95 Honda Accord that I'm still driving, and that's a very country music topic about your car breaking down, although it's usually worse than my speedometer.
Yeah, I don't know.
You literally can't drive 55.
Actually, I found a great app. It's called Waze, W-A-Z-E, and I just set it in my dashboard, and it tells me how fast I'm going. And so,
the problem is now you can't text and drive.
That is a problem.
Well, we should get into country music, which will involve some cars, I'm sure, at some point, working or otherwise. So we're talking today about the 1970s. What we've seen in the past few episodes, and really since we started doing this, is a tension between the bland, pop-like country music that sells well, and attempts by purists to restore or reinvigorate country music. So, for example, when the Nashville sound that we talked about, I think, last time, starts to be a bit mainstream, the Bakersfield sound acts as a corrective. In the 1970s, country music finally strikes some kind of formula that results in unqualified commercial success, but still has real country appeal. And this is a quote from the book Country Music USA. The country music industry has discovered that its best interests lie in the distribution of a package with clouded identity possessing no regional traits. The industry has strived to present a music that is all things to all people, middle of the road and American, but also southern, working class, and occasionally youth-oriented and even rebellious in tone. End quote. Now, as always in the past, this leads to debates about what's real country versus not real country, and results and artists and movements who try to push country music back to its roots. Unlike in the past, the tendency since the 70s has simply been for these artists to be absorbed into the amorphous blob that is country music, which in turn has become part of the even more amorphous blob that is mainstream American culture. And just as some examples of this action in the 70s, which again is where we're mostly focusing today. In 1974, the Grand Ole Opry moves from its traditional home in the Ryman Auditorium in Nashville. This isn't necessarily a bad thing. The Ryman was not air conditioned, which isn't, you know, ideal for Nashville, and it wasn't very well heated. Acoustics were good, but visibility was terrible. You know, if you were sitting in the audience, the odds that you would be sitting behind a pillar or a column were pretty high. There was no parking, and the building itself was in a rundown part of town, full of adult bookstores and pornographic movie theaters. And if either of you want to explain what those are to our younger listeners, I'll give you a chance to do so now.
Yeah, pornographic movie theaters. In the old days, before the internet, if you wanted to watch a porno movie, you had to go to a dimly lit theater and watch it with a bunch of other dudes, and I'm sure it was all dudes.
Although
I'm very associated with the 1970s. Like, I think of them as being a very taxi driver phenomenon.
That's the image that was coming to my head, actually. But wasn't there a time, like, maybe it was more in the 60s, where that became like a... I don't know, a cause celeb in intellectual circles, like.
Oh, probably. Is there any sort of perversity that won't find some set of intellectuals to praise it?
Yeah, probably so. Yeah.
Our younger listeners may remember, or I guess not younger listeners my age may know porno theaters best as the thing that ruined Pee Wee Herman's career, because Paul Rubens, who plays Pee Wee Herman, got caught masturbating in a pornographic movie theater, and that was kind of the end of Pee Wee's Playhouse. And there's a number of off color jokes to be made there, but I'll let Coyle make them if he's interested in doing so.
If I do, they will have been edited out, so the listener will never know it. Anyway, the point is,
what a weird phenomenon in American cultural history, the pornographic movie theater. I'm too young for it. I probably wouldn't have gone to one even if I wasn't too young for it. That is just, it really goes to show you how much men want to watch pornography.
I mean, for what it's worth, I don't know that it's just American. I'm assuming that other places, other countries have them too. I don't know. I have no idea.
The Ryman is still open, isn't it?
What's that?
Yeah.
To return to the subject at hand.
Yeah. So they move to the Opry House. So the new home of the Opry is the Opry House, which is kind of large and modern, you know, for the 1970s. And sitting on 110 acres of what ended up being kind of a hillbilly Disneyland, complete with rides and attractions called Opryland. It actually closed.
There.
What's that?
I've been there.
Yeah, it closed in the late 90s, although, I mean, obviously the stuff is still there. Since the 90s, the Opry has bounced back and forth between the Opry House and the Ryman Auditorium. So it's still open and it's still operating. They just kind of move it around depending on what they need and what they're doing. The last show at the Ryman, last sort of official show at the Ryman in the 70s, was covered for The New Yorker by Garrison Keillor. Who was so moved that he started Prairie Home Companion as an attempt to hold on to some of the flavor and atmosphere of the old-time radio broadcast from the Opry.
Oh, that's interesting. I didn't know that.
Yeah, I mean, it makes sense. Like, I didn't know that before I was reading this history, but I can see that connection there now that I read it.
And the Ryman has been, like, renovated, right? And,
oh, yeah.
Like, I know Jason Isbell.
My parents were just there a few weeks ago.
Oh, okay, because Jason Isbell released, he had like three straight nights at the Ryman, and he made a live album out of it and stuff, and I think it's actually kind of like a prestige venue at this point for certain artists.
Yeah, and they've updated the, I don't know if there's parking yet or not, but they've updated the air conditioning and the heating and all of that. The building has been refurbished, but in the 70s it was still kind of a cesspool.
Could you still go to a pornographic movie theater after the show? Or?
You know, I don't know, and I didn't Google that, so I couldn't say. Another example of this mainstreamization of country music is in media. Through the 70s, country music's media footprint expands exponentially through television, although only in very specific formats on television, but then also through movies and through Top 40 radio. So in television, in the 60s, we saw network TV shows pop up like Hee Haw and the Johnny Cash Show. By the early 1980s, shows like that are almost always run through cable, especially after the Nashville Network is created in 1983. Really, where country music makes the biggest splash on network TV are first on specials and award shows. So viewers might struggle to tune in every week to watch a network country music TV show. They seem to be willing to watch the occasional special, usually to very high ratings. So the Country Music Awards especially makes a splash and largely continues to do so down to the present. And then the second place on TV where country really takes off is through public television. Shows like Austin City Limits, broadcasts of the Grand Ole Opry, combined with Prairie Home Companion on the radio, they open up country music to a different class of audience than it had been traditionally exposed to, and we can talk more about that later. Also, I think
Austin City. I'm sorry to interrupt you.
No, go for it.
How much was Austin City Limits limited to country music in its early days? Because of course now it's not. You get rock bands playing Austin City Limits pretty much all the time. Was it originally just a country show?
There's a famous Tom Waits version of that from the 70s, and so it's got to be pretty early on. They were already pretty, and that I think reflects Austin's taste, though.
Yeah,
it's just kind of generally left of center music,
right? Yeah. Well, not
politically necessarily, but you know, stuff that's not exactly mainstream, but also not. It's not like who am I thinking? It's not like Faust or somebody like that is playing. It's people who are still mainstream, but not right down the center.
Proto-Americana, probably.
Right. Well, and people who are intentionally blurring genres, and we'll get to that in a minute also, right? That's what Austin is trying to do. That's the music scene in Austin. So even if they had limited Austin City Limits to country, which I don't know if they did or not, I don't know enough about the history of the show, it still wouldn't have necessarily been just country singers. Let's see, where were we? In the 70s, country music also starts to make inroads in film. So country songs increasingly are part of the soundtrack of movies, you know, things like Smokey and the Bandit. But films about country music or starring country music singers also start to take off. So Coal Miner's Daughter earned Sissy Spacek an Academy Award. Dolly Parton became well-known, at least in part, through movies like 9 to 5 and The Best Little Whorehouse in Texas. Even Willie Nelson becomes known as a character actor in several films.
Actor is putting his film roles very, very courteous.
Yeah. You got to have that character actor on the front of that, right?
He's very much the model for Tom Petty's film career.
Yeah. He plays himself in a lot of movies. How about that? Even if he has a different name.
Have you seen the Willie Nelson? Is it Kris Kristofferson's also in it? Stagecoach?
No, I haven't seen that one.
Yeah, so they remake the John Ford classic Stagecoach in the 70s, and it is terrible. I mean, Kristofferson, whatever you want to say about his acting, is an actual actor, probably better known for being an actor now than for being a singer. But man, Willie Nelson and Johnny Cash, too, I believe, is in that movie. Neither one of them are really actors as such.
No. I'm always a little, and I don't think that necessarily anyone in Hollywood was thinking of this at the time, but have you seen the movie Paint Your Wagon?
Oh, with Clint Eastwood.
Clint Eastwood and Lee Marvin. It is a terrible movie, and it's an even worse musical. But I think it would have been made, you know, 5 or 10% better if instead of Lee Marvin and Clint Eastwood trying to sing, they'd used Kris Kristofferson and Willie Nelson.
I gotta say, my only experience to that is the Simpsons parody of it, where Homer rents Paint Your Wagon is horrified to discover it's a musical.
Right. Which is, that parody is so much better than the original. Finally, in terms of country music going sort of into American culture, a top 40 radio starts to carry country music as the genre functionally becomes indistinguishable from pop. The crossover style performances from the 50s of Jerry Lee Lewis, Elvis, and Johnny Cash are recaptured for new audiences in the 70s by artists like Glen Campbell and Ann Murray, who both stand with one foot in country and one foot in pop and don't even try to draw lines between the genres. Maybe even more telling of country's blending into mainstream pop music is the fact that Kenny Rogers won the People's Choice Award for Top Male Artist 3 years in a row.
Oh, but I mean, I don't know. You know, 10 years ago, I would have ragged on Kenny Rogers, but the truth is that guy can sing. He's a great singer.
Yep.
And Glenn Campbell even more so. I mean, I feel like we've talked about him before on this show.
We have.
I don't want to cover ground we've already covered before.
And again, there are lots of examples we could give like that. I especially like the Southern rock artists, people who are for all intents and purposes rock and roll singers, but they're from the South and their subject matter is traditional country music subject matter. So Hank Williams Jr., Charlie Daniels, Charlie Daniels starts as a session musician in Nashville and plays there on a Bob Dylan country concept album. They just have across the board appeal. I mean, they're going to fit in basically anywhere. And this is a time when Austin, Texas comes on the scene as a place where genres are intentionally fused together in experimental ways. Not because there's a record label organizing this, but because the clubs and bars of Austin are where the sorts of people who appreciate a broad range of music assemble. So Janis Joplin and Steve Earle, Emmylou Harris, Rodney Crowell, all either begin there or gravitate there as a place from which to launch their careers, while established figures like, I don't want to steal anything from Michael, so I won't get into the established figures. If they want to move in a different direction, they leave Nashville and go to Austin for rebranding. And then finally, politics. Rather than leave politics to the end, I went ahead and threw it in at the beginning here. One of the ways country music really enters mainstream American life is through its largely bipartisan use by politicians. So Lyndon Johnson would host barbecues at the White House and at his ranch in Texas for government officials, for visiting dignitaries from other nations, and he would often have live country music performances providing the background music. Nixon liked the criticism of hippies that country music often provided and the generally conservative feel of country music, so he would invite performers to the White House, including Merle Haggard and Johnny Cash. There's this famous story about Nixon asked Johnny Cash to play Okie from Muskogee, and Johnny Cash said no, and Nixon cracked some line about, well, you clearly don't tell Johnny Cash what to play or not to play, and later Cash was like, look, I just didn't know the song. Like, it wasn't a political statement, it wasn't a, you know, defying the president, I didn't know how to sing it. So Nixon actually goes to the opening of the new Opry House right in the middle of the Watergate crisis. So he is trying to identify himself with this popular genre. Jimmy Carter, of course, I mean, what can you say about Carter? Of all of these presidents, he's the one who actually seemed to like it, just for its own sake. And country music tended to like him. So several prominent country singers, Willie Nelson, Johnny Cash, Loretta Lynn, they actively campaigned for Carter in 1980. And even Ronald Reagan, despite having all of these country singers campaign against him, continues to endorse country music by bringing performers to the White House. So the 25th anniversary of the Country Music Association was held in D.C. The pinnacle of it was a performance of the Lonesome Road Blues by Bill Monroe, Ricky Skaggs, Grandpa Jones, and Robert Byrd, which is the Senator Robert Byrd from West Virginia. The singer Reagan brought into the White House most was Merle Haggard, who'd received a pardon from Reagan, when Reagan was governor of California. In 1982, Haggard publicly endorses Reaganomics. So, in the 70s, country music has hit its maturity. It's moved into a little White House in the suburbs with a spouse and two cars in the garage and 2.5 children and all of that, which I think is worth stopping and kind of looking around at the landscape of country music, especially in some of the movements that stand out a little bit. So unless you guys have anything to add to any of that, I know it's been me monologuing a while, so sorry about that. If you have anything to add, we should throw it in now. Otherwise, we'll turn things over to Danny.
The other piece I think you might be missing a little bit is the country rock movement. And again, it's been months since we recorded the last episode, so
sure.
Maybe we already talked about this before.
I don't think we did.
But you mentioned Emmylou Harris, who comes to prominence first as the kind of harmony vocal singer for this guy Graham Parsons, who's really the father of the Americana movement. He's with the Flying Burrito Brothers, and then he's with the Byrds, and then he's with the International Submarine Band, and finally he releases two albums under his own name, and then dies of a drug overdose in the desert in California. But there's probably no figure more important for underground country music in the 90s than Graham Parsons, and for that matter, given that he's the one who turned the Byrds onto country music, or at least helped them make Sweetheart of the Rodeo, there's probably no figure more important for 70s country rock either. And so I think you've got to look at it coming from that side too. So at the same time, Kenny Rogers is winning Artist of the Year or whatever, the Eagles are making a really inoffensive brand of soft country rock, right? Or Jackson Browne is doing the same thing, a little less on the countryside. Or you have, I mean, you mentioned Southern rock, but the country rock is the other side of that. The stuff that's a little less indebted to the blues, a little less sprawling, a little softer by and large. Poco, or help me out, I can't think of any more 70s country rock groups.
I mean, I guess I don't know where you would put them. Leonard Skinner is the one that always pops
up. Skinner
is
more of a Southern rock band, right. So a little bit more indebted to hard rock, you know, kind of jam bandy.
Kind of Neil Young floats in and out of this, as he defaults into a lot of things, I guess. But
Neil Young has a finger in almost every pie in the 70s, doesn't he?
Yeah.
But sure, I mean, something like Harvest, his album Harvest, I think is a pretty clear example of country rock. So I don't know how many people from the mainstream country establishment would accept those folks, but I think they've got to be part of this story. And once we get to outlaw country, the line between country rock and outlaw country is very thin indeed.
Yeah, and it's interesting that they're for all of their acceptance of so many things, and they're trying to sort of be neutral on what is or isn't country, there are still lines drawn. So I can't imagine I ever heard an Eagles song on the classic country station when I was growing up.
And yet, there was a very prominent country Eagles tribute album in the early 90s.
Yeah. So I heard Clint Black's version of Desperado all the time. Right. So, again, it's there is still something there, some willingness to draw some kind of lines, even though, as you point out, they're pretty fuzzy lines at the time.
Conway Twitty covered the Eagles
terribly,
as he did everything terribly.
Yeah. we're not quite to where I have to defend some Conway Twitty yet, but we're getting close.
Urban cowboy.
that's for the next episode. Although outlaw country kind of blends into that a little bit. Well, Danny, talk to us about minorities in country music.
Well, I mean, as you can imagine, it's a fraught and barely disguised racism at some points, right? Especially early on. And it's interesting, actually, to begin with to the present. And I think it's interesting that as much as pop country has kind of gentrified, if you will, has kind of made into or just this general kind of middle brow pop music with a Southern accent. There are definitely more African-American performers in mainstream country music. Darius Rucker is a pretty prominent
of
Hootie, right? He's a prominent example of this, but not to the degree they're still not as present to the degree to which country music has kind of broadened its appeal. Like, they haven't brought in as many African-American performers as you think that it would have.
It's more that they brought hip-hop into country music rather than bringing in African-American performers into country music.
Yeah, exactly, right? And I think on one of these old episodes, I recently read a quote from Steve Earle, who said that country music on the radio today is like hip-hop for people who are afraid of black people, right? And so I think I think that actually holds true to an alarming extent. But I
do have to say one thing about that before we move on. The number one Billboard song in the country, as we're recording this, and it's been number one for 2 months, I think, is a song called Old Town Road by Lil Nas X.
Yes.
Featuring Billy Ray Cyrus.
Yes.
Which...
Yeah, I'm gonna take my horse to the Old Town Road. I'm gonna ride till I can't no more. I'm gonna take my horse through the Old Town Road. I'm gonna ride till I can't no more.
I got the horses in the back, horse stock is attached. Head is matted black, got the bushes black to match. Riding on a horse, ha, you can whip your Porsche. I've been in a valley.
That's the kind of weird world of cross pollination we're living in. But that is a black artist playing country music in a certain way.
Yes, right. And a way that's been wholly embraced by country music, right? And so I'm not saying it doesn't exist, and it definitely exists to a greater degree than it ever has, but not to the degree to which you would expect at this point in history, right? And although, by the way, that Country Road, whether the Billy Ray Cyrus, he, every time I hear that, he sounds exactly like Yondu from Guardians of the Galaxy, and that's all I can hear.
It kind of looks like Yondu.
Is Yondu singing that part? And so, in fact, that's who I thought it was when my daughter first played it for me. I'm like, is that Yondu? And like, no, it's Billy Ray Cyrus. Anyway, but I think you can trace a lot of this back to, I mean, the roots of country music when it split. In that kind of post-Jimmy Rogers era, when there became a distinct split between the blues and country music. We talked about that all the way back in the first one of these episodes, right? And with the first person that I think is worth talking about here, and I'm really grateful, actually, to Coyle for writing this in the notes. I was completely unaware, and I was just fascinated by the story of Dee Ford Bailey, who is a harmonica player who opened up the radio broadcast of the Grand Ole Opry for WSM when they were carrying that broadcast. And so he was like a fixture of the Grand Ole Opry for a long time, this African-American guy playing this really amazing blues harmonica, like in sort of mimicking train sounds. You can find clips of him on YouTube performing, and it's really remarkable. And at some point, there's some kind of strange, and I wasn't able to dig up too many details about this, there's some sort of strange rights management issues with his songs, and because of some conflict between like BMI or whoever, ASCAP, they were unable to play his songs on the radio, so they just fired him, and he ended up just drifting off into obscurity for the rest of his life. He was shining shoes in some hotel someplace, and it's like one of the kind of tragic stories in music history that I've even heard of, like in general music history, because he's a remarkably important figure in reinventing an old style for a modern audience, and was just dropped. And yes, there was this sort of copyright issue, but I mean, he was the only black performer for many years in the Grand Ole Opry. And so it's that kind of, you almost have this original sin of racism with the way that country music didn't fight for or didn't appreciate Dee Ford Bailey. And so Dee Ford Bailey is, I think, a place to start this conversation.
He's also the first person named on radio or TV at the Grand Ole Opry. Like, he is the first person introduced.
Yes.
So the first name to appear kind of publicly is his name.
Yeah, right. And it's still, he's a bridge between this older time when the blues and country music were not so distinct by racial lines, right? And bands like the Carolina Chocolate Drops now are hearkening back to that time, right? And so, but it's taken a long time to get to the Carolina Chocolate Drops, obviously. And so from there, you really, I mean, there, it's very difficult to find any kind of minority participation in country music, in mainstream radio country music, at least, until Ray Charles in 1962 releases one of his kind of seminal albums. It's called Modern Sounds in Country and Western Music, and it wasn't until doing the prep for the show that I realized that's where Sturgill Simpson got the name for his album, Meta Modern Sounds in Country Music. I didn't even make that connection until now. But this was a really landmark album, and holds up today as a legitimately great album that does kind of, it's not Ray Charles faking country music. It's Ray Charles making a bridge between the soul and R&B and country music, right? The effect of this album is that it creates a legitimacy for country music, for one thing, right? So there's a bidirectional relationship between, you know, African-American performers and the country music establishment. Ray Charles actually legitimizes country music for a lot of people in 1962 by performing this album. And so that is one reason that lots of people talk about it as maybe the most important album of the 60s for country music, because of what it did for country music. But it also, I think, opens a crack for white acceptance, you know, the traditional white country music fan of minorities and particularly African Americans. And so after that moment, you get to see you see people like Freddie Fender, who's a sort of a Mexican American performer, who kind of mixes, and he doesn't hide his ethnicity, right? Freddie Fender mixes Mexican musical traditions with country music, right? And so there's a sense in which Freddie Fender is another kind of really important figure who gains really prominent mainstream acceptance in the 1970s. And I think largely on the groundwork that Ray Charles set up about a decade before in 1962. Freddie Fender is one. Another one that kind of came to my mind is Johnny Rodriguez, who's kind of not remembered. I mean, his music sounds kind of banal in retrospect. There's a couple of good songs. My favorite of his songs is Riding My Thumb to Mexico.
This old highway seems so lonesome when you're going where you've been. And a lonesome song can make you cry time and time again. If I had listened to a friend of mine 10 years ago today, I'd have a better job than what I got today. But the billboards on the highways and the brake lights on the cars make me jump out on the highway with my bag and my guitar. If she comes or if she goes, it doesn't matter anymore, 'cause I'm riding my thumb to Mexico. Riding my thumb to Mexico. It don't matter when or how I go. I'll ride this thumb till I see her again, so I'm riding my thumb to Mexico.
But that's kind of a... The lyrics aren't really great. The lyrics are kind of clumsily written, but it's a really catchy tune. And but he is someone also from Mexican American descent, and so he's someone
probably
who came
best remembered today for the line in David Allan Coe's Long Haired Redneck about him stealing the goat. Wouldn't you say? Like, I think that's where most people know who he is.
Probably so. And he's actually an interesting figure too, because he connects back to the. Oh, I guess the outlaw image of country music. He was actually in prison. His father died young, and he had a, you know, I think a brother who also died very quickly. So he kind of fell into kind of juvenile crime, and he was singing in jail, and a jailkeeper heard him and really liked his voice, and talked a local club owner into letting him sing when he got out. And so he was singing there, and Tom T. Hall discovers him and then brings him to Nashville, and he almost immediately gets a record deal and has this... Actually, I mean, he's a reliable hit maker throughout the 70s, and to this day he performs. He's still alive and still performing. So Johnny Rodriguez is someone we don't remember because he's kind of that... more kind of banal countrypolitan style, right. I think, largely. So he's just not as memorable as someone like Freddie Fender, but very important. Go ahead.
Didn't Freddie Fender spend some time in jail too?
Yes, he did.
Mid-career.
Freddie Fender actually served, was it 3 years? For like just possession of marijuana. It was like one of those, it was something, some kind of like, idiotic like law, right? That he actually, maybe it wasn't 3 years, but he's spent a little bit of time in jail because of that. And someone with the governor of the state that it was in, I think it was Louisiana, was a musician who had affinity for Freddie Fender, and he pardoned him, but as part of the parole, he was supposed to stay out of music for a few years, because I guess music was this corrupting influence or something. So Freddie Fender also did have a record, I guess. Whether that was actually criminal or not is up for debate. But so this, although, happens in the 70s, when in the post-civil rights movement, there is like a crack in the door for ethnic minorities to have not only success, but like great success in mainstream country music, right? And so, and this, of course, all comes to a head with Charlie Pride, who in the early 70s, who I actually did not realize played in the Negro Leagues. He was a baseball player. He was a pitcher who actually pitched in the Negro Leagues. I did not know that. And it was a fascinating, Charlie Pride is of that style. I just find that kind of 70s countrypolitan to be the least interesting form of country music, although by today's standards, it's remarkably great. You know what I mean? And according to whatever's popular now, I think I would prefer that by far. But, and so I kind of was always dismissive, I guess, a little bit of Charlie Pride. I mean, I appreciated his, you know, achievement in breaking the color barrier, but his music just always seemed kind of forgettable on some level for me, largely. But it was actually, I reevaluated that in doing some research. Charlie Pride had a really kind of remarkable career, and in addition to the transition from the Negro League baseball into some minor league stints with like the Yankees organization, into country stardom, and he was as big a star as country music had in the 1970s. And I believe only Elvis sold more records for RCA than Charlie Pride did. In that period. And so it's a remarkable success story. And he had like worldwide success. He was also important, it turns out, in Northern Irish politics. There was an embargo on music performing in Northern Ireland during the Troubles in the mid-70s. And Charlie Pride went over there. He met some promoter and went over there and performed, and is still kind of beloved to this day in Northern Ireland by all sides, because after him taking on that, like that opened up the avenue for other performers from, you know, the rest of America and Europe to go and perform in Northern Ireland. So he's a much more interesting figure than I thought he was. And so in addition to the massive success, though, so Charlie Pride is sort of like a first ballot country music Hall of Famer, right? Like dozens and dozens of hits and number one singles every year, Entertainer of the Year. So he's universally accepted by country music. And I think I remember my parents talking about when he first came out, like people didn't even, because he just would hear them on the radio. No one knew he was black, right? And so, and when he sort of emerges on the stage at the Grand Ole Opry, it was kind of a shock to people, right? But he like won them over. So Charlie Pride is that sort of the success story for ethnic minorities in country music. But also another, I have to give it to Coyle for this one. I was unaware that Tina Turner released a country album, which has the greatest name for an album, Tina Turns the Country On. It's a great name for an album. And I can only, it's still to this day not been released in CD format. And so it's like, it's kind of almost an unappreciated lost record. There's a really terrible recording of it on YouTube that I listened to, and it's really good. I can't believe that this album hasn't been sort of rediscovered and just sort of appreciated. It is like weirdly unremembered. It came out in 1974. It was a way for, I think, Ike Turner to market Tina at the time. But it's a really successful album artistically. And I mean, she's going to sing beautifully, and the arrangements are great, and I really, really enjoyed listening to that. And so I think that that's another moment where you see it wasn't accepted so much by white audiences, but you do see an acceptance of country music by black performers in that album. And so in addition and beyond that, I mean, you have a couple of almost novelty acts. I mean, so Cole, you had written down Ray Benson from Asleep at the Wheel. So they're like, I'm not saying they're a novelty act. He's Jewish, but that doesn't really play a role in his music at all, as far as I can tell.
But he doesn't have a Jewish name, right? Right. I mean, Benson is a pretty Anglo name.
Yes, exactly. So, I mean, he, I think, is just sort of ethnically Jewish and successful. I mean, I guess he can pass in country music the way assimilated Jews have passed in all kinds of other fields, right? And so I think that this is, at that time especially. But this is not to say that Asleep at the Wheel is not a great, great band. I love Asleep at the Wheel. They were a really great Texas swing band that, I mean, I think is an all-time band. They're really, really great.
Yeah, they've been going for 70 years. I mean, they just keep switching out members.
Yeah. Yeah, and so in his baritone voice, that perfect like swing voice that he has, lends a lot to it. And he is a Jewish man who has a prominent place in WASPy country music, right? And so, but the other person then that is important to talk about is Kinky Friedman, who's a very idiosyncratic person. I've always known about Kinky Friedman. I'd never really sat down and paid attention to his music, and so I did, the last couple weeks, listening to his songs. Some very funny, hugely offensive satire.
They don't make Jews like Jesus anymore.
Yeah, they don't make Jews like Jesus anymore, which is basically him talking down a racist, but he uses like the N-word in the song, and it's like wildly offensive, right, on any number of levels. And he's like one of those figures. I think he fashions himself as like a Will Rogers satirist,
yeah,
who just happens to play country music, right? And so, but he also does writing and stuff. But he also, I think, is very much a part of that kind of late 60s Philip Roth Portnoy's Complaint era of like sticking it to propriety just for the sake of sticking it to propriety. So there is, he does fit in with a certain moment of Jewish cultural satire, I think. And it just comes across as country music, and it's utterly bizarre, right? Another one, he parodies Merle Haggard's Okie from Muskogee, A-hole from El Paso. Of course, the rhyme works better if you use the unredacted version of the slur, right? But it's a really great like piece of parody that also works as country music. And so Kinky Friedman has had a long career, and he's run into all kinds of trouble. One really offensive anti-feminist song?
Get your biscuits in the oven and your buns in the bed.
Uppity women, I don't understand why you gotta go try to act like a man. But before you make your weekly visit to the shrink, you better occupy the kitchen, liberate the sink. Get your biscuits in the oven and your buns in the bed. That's what I do, my baby said. On the generation, it's going to your head. Get your biscuits in the oven and your
Yes. So he actually got in trouble for that one in Buffalo, apparently. He said, what did he call them? Some like hopped up lesbians or something. Stormed the stage and started a fight. And he didn't go back to Buffalo till like 1992 or something. But he won, quote unquote, like male misogynist of the year or some award from some advocacy group. And so he's a wildly offensive, weirdly hilarious performer that owns his Jewishness, right? And so right. That is the only case I can think of where somebody like flaunts their ethnicity in country music, right? And of course, he never makes it on country radio. I mean, he's a figure from Texas who, you can talk about Texas all you want. They have a very kind of broad appreciation for music, right? And so he's big in Texas, I think, but it doesn't play on Nashville at all.
Because of the content.
Of Austin.
What? Yeah. I mean, it's because of the content. So Freddie Fender flaunts his race isn't the right way to say it, but I mean, several of his most famous songs have verses in Spanish.
Yes.
Right.
Johnny Rodriguez, same thing.
So. Yeah, same thing with Johnny Rodriguez. They both make it, and Kinky Friedman only makes it as like you say, a novelty act, to the point where he's like he does still perform, but he's he's primarily writing books. And
have either of you read any of his mystery novels?
Oh, they're great.
Yeah, they're very funny.
They're much better than any of his songs.
I read one where Willie Nelson goes missing and he tries to find him.
Yeah.
And every time he sees Willie, he describes him as smoking a blunt the size of a torpedo. It starts as a torpedo and ends up as like a nuclear submarine or something. We would be remiss to talk about Kinky Friedman without talking about his run for governor of Texas in 2005, 2006.
Oh, that was so great.
You got the slogan, which was, of the why vote. The hell not?
He got 12% of the vote, right?
I thought he was going to win. He ran against Rick, what's his name? Rick Perry.
Rick Perry. Governor
Good Hair.
Yeah, he gave an interview where, I mean, apparently he and Rick Perry are buddies, so they, you know, it's fine personally between them. But the interview asked him some question about Rick Perry, and he's like, when I die, I want to be cremated and have my ashes thrown in Rick Perry's face.
He also wanted to make Willie Nelson the Secretary of Energy for Texas because of his adoption of biodiesel.
Yeah, he's a singular figure, though, in country music, right? There's no sort of Kinky Friedman tradition, I don't think, that follows him. But this all does happen in the 70s. And so there is something, I think you can trace it back. I mean, you have the kind of horrible treatment of Dee Ford Bailey early on in popular country music. And then you have Ray Charles's really groundbreaking album in the early part of the 60s, right kind of at the cusp of the civil rights movement, right in the middle of the civil rights movement. Mm-hmm. And then you have this kind of open door. In the 70s, you do have a lot of representation from ethnic minorities in country music, although that doesn't really seem to spawn any kind of inheritors. All right, there's no. I'm thinking of the 80s. I think in the 80s you see a lot more acceptance of women in country music.
Right.
That you don't have up until this point, but you don't really see a tradition of mainstream acceptance of African American or Hispanic country music acts. There's a couple, like Buckwheat Zydeco will play on some albums every now and then, but there's not right. It didn't spawn a tradition, and that has continued to this day, I think.
I think it's telling when there was this African American country rapper in the mid 2000s called Cowboy Troy.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at all the press around Cowboy Troy, the only person they compare him to is Charlie Pride. Of course, I mean, he sounds nothing like,
right.
But that's the only major black figure in country music before Cowboy Troy. He was himself not major in any way.
Right.
He was on that Big and Rich album,
that's
right?
That's right. Best known in a couple of verses for Big and Rich. Themselves a horrifying footnote in the history of country music.
Yeah. I'm not a fan. That awful Save a Horse, Ride a Cowboy song.
$100 bills, and it kills and it thrills like the horns on my Silverado grill. And I buy the bar a double round of Crown, and everybody's getting down in this town. Ain't never gonna be the same, 'cause I saddle up my horse and I ride into the city. I make a lot of noise, 'cause the girls, they are so pretty. Riding up and down Broadway on my old Studley Roy.
Ugh.
Every
yeah, well, that was an era of tremendous vulgarity in country music.
Oh, and every sporting event, because our team at the University of Wyoming is the Cowboys, so every game they played that stupid song, and ugh.
I take Charlie Pride over that. Charlie Pride has one great song at least. Is Anybody Going to San Antone?
Dripping off the brim of my hat, sure is cold today. Here I am walking down 66, wish she hadn't done me that way. Sleeping under a table in a roadside park, a man could wake up dead.
but it sure seems warmer than it did sleeping in our king-sized bed. Is anybody going to San Antonio or Phoenix, Arizona? Any place is all right as long as I can forget I've ever known her.
I have a newfound respect for Charlie Pride. Going back and listening, it just I meant to say that it was a I kind of considered him like Conway Twitty, right? But he actually has a lot of really great singles, right? And he was of that era and super successful and a lot of really really good songs. Yeah.
Am I misremembering that he has a theater in Branson?
I don't know.
Coyle neighborhood.
There's a good chance that he does, but I honestly don't know. I know Ray Stevens has one.
He did, or had at one point. Maybe he doesn't anymore. I don't know. I've never been to Branson. Lifelong dream.
Yeah.
Coyle should host the Christian Humanist Radio Network conference in Branson. He lives right up the road from it.
We should just buy a theater in Branson.
It seems that there used to be.
Oh, it used to be a Charlie Pride theater.
Yeah, he still performs in Branson regularly, but
like
there is no longer
Smirnoff's theater instead.
hey man, he's back. He briefly retired. Have I told you guys this?
Yakov is kind of the closest equivalent to Kiki Friedman, if you think about it.
So the year that we moved here, Yakov Smirnoff retired to go be a family counselor. He got like his PhD in family counseling and decided that he was done with comedy. And so we watched this local news interview with him. He's like, yeah, the Soviet Union collapsed, and that was kind of the end of my comedy. So I had to go somewhere where they didn't know the Soviet Union had collapsed, so I moved to Branson. But, you know, of course, now it's 20 years later. So he got his degree in family counseling, retired from comedy, 7 years ago or whatever, and now he's back doing comedy in Branson.
So, can you imagine walking into a therapist's office and Yakov Smirnoff is sitting there? How many people do you think made a in Soviet Russia joke when they came into his office?
Oh, yeah.
You must That's no Bolshevik.
Hey, listeners, at this point, Michael, Danny, and I continue to talk for another hour about women in country music in the 70s and about outlaw country. Rather than have a two-hour episode, we decided to go ahead and cut it in half. So tune in next time for the exciting conclusion of country music in the 1970s. And until then, thank you again for listening. Thank you, Michael and Danny, for joining us on the show. This is the City of Man podcast, a part of the Christian Humanist Radio Network. Our press liaison is Kristen Filipic. Please check out the other podcasts in our family. Get more information about our own show or our show notes by visiting christianhumanist.org. Please also leave us a review on iTunes to help other people find our show. Like our Facebook page at facebook.com/cityofmanpodcast or drop us an email at cityofmanpodcast@gmail.com. This is Coyle Neal, and on behalf of Edward Song, let me remind you to render unto Caesar those things that are Caesar's and render unto God those things that are God's.
End of a 100-year wars. The voices sound sad as they're singing long. Another piece of America's lost.